James Lowen is a professor emeritus of the University of Vermont, and he has written a great deal about American history, about how we get it wrong, how our textbooks get it wrong, and how our historical sites get it wrong. James Lowen, are you there?
I am.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
And you're now in Washington, D.C., are you not?
That's right.
And before we find out why you're in Washington, D.C., I'd like to ask you some questions of how you ever got interested in doing the kind of work you do. You've written two books, you've written many books, but two very well-known books, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Teacher Got Wrong, and Lies Across America, What Our History Markers and Monuments Get Wrong, and even your earlier books on Mississippi and the Mississippi Chinese. It seems like you're a sociologist by training, are you not?
Yes.
But yet you write a great deal about American history. How did it come to be that way?
Well, it's an interesting story. I spent my first 8 years of full-time teaching at a black college, Tougaloo College. It's a small college in Tougaloo, Mississippi. It's a very good college, but it's not well-known at all outside of the Deep South. So there I was teaching my first year sociology courses, but I was also asked to teach a unit of the freshman social science seminar. Now, this was a course that the history department had devised to replace the usual Western Civ course that was required in every school in America just about at one time, including black colleges. And so it introduced students to sociology, my home discipline, and to psych, and to anthro, and econ, and poli-sci, and so on. And it did this in the context of African-American history. And had, as I said, it had been devised by the history department. Now, when you're in that context, that's the same chronology as American history. So second semester began, and second semester in that chronology begins with Reconstruction, of course. And I had a new group of students, and I didn't want to do all the talking that first day of class. And so I asked them, okay, what's Reconstruction? You know, what happened then? And it was one of these aha experiences, although this was more like an oh-no experience. 16 out of 17 of them said, well, that was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. And my little heart sank because there are three direct lies, if you will, in that sentence. For those of us, including myself, actually, this is not just a Mississippi problem, but for those of us who grew up learning history in high school before 1960, that's pretty much what we learned. And so for those listeners amongst us like that, the first lie is that blacks never took over the government of the southern states. All of the southern states had white governors throughout the period. All but one had white legislative majorities. Second of all, the Reconstruction governments did not, on the whole, screw up. Throughout the South, they wrote the best state constitutions that the states have ever had in the South, including today. They established public school systems for both races. They had not been a system for whites, and there had not been any schools for blacks. They did various other things. And the third lie, then, is that white folks didn't take control at the end of Reconstruction. Instead, a certain group of whites, white racist Democrats, mostly plantation owners, took control using KKK tactics, and it was, of course, the original Ku Klux Klan. So I'm thinking, what must it do to you to believe that the one time your group was center stage in American history, they screwed up? Can't possibly be good for your psyche, for your academic development, for anything else. If it was true, you have to face it and deal with it, but it wasn't. So that's when I became aware that history can be a weapon, that it can be used against you, and that it had, in fact, been used against my students.
I just want to go into more detail about your experience in Mississippi and what drew you down to Mississippi in the first place.
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I went to Carleton College in Minnesota. I grew up in Illinois. I had never really been out of the Midwest. I mean, you know, I had had my one-week trip to Washington, D.C. once, and my parents had gone to Yellowstone National Park once with me. That doesn't count. And I'm, you know, my friends in French, they're spending their junior year abroad in France. My friends in German, they're going off to Germany. And I'm thinking, well, here I am in sociology, and I've never been out of the Midwest. So I invented a junior year abroad in Mississippi, if you will. And in 1963, the year I'm talking about, Mississippi was as far as you could get and be a foreign, you know, the closest towards a foreign country. This was just after James Meredith and the Meredith riot at Ole Miss. And so that's why I went there. And so I went to Mississippi State, which is what at the time was the largest all-white segregated school in America. And that's one of the reasons I went there, to see what that was all about. And while I was there, I spent a week at Tougaloo. I also spent a week at Tuskegee, Tuskegee Institute over in Alabama. And that's when I learned of the existence of Tougaloo, and I really fell in love with the place because, unlike Mississippi State, and for that matter, unlike Tuskegee, it was basically a liberal arts college, and it had students who were intellectual and who thought, who read books that weren't even assigned in class, just like Carleton did. So when I finished my Ph.D., I invited Tougaloo to make me a job offer, and it was a wonderful time to be a finishing graduate student, I might add, because we were just on the beginning of the baby boom, and so there's jobs all over the place, but I chose the Tougaloo offer.
It seems like since a very early time in your career, you've been interested in uncovering aspects of our past that are little known, or that are little known at least by a broad population. I'm thinking back at your dissertation, which became the Mississippi Chinese.
Yes, that was a wonderful choice for a dissertation. And if there's anybody in graduate school listening to my voice, I would suggest you pick a topic for your dissertation that nobody knows anything about. For God's sake, don't pick the topic that your advisor-to-be is expert on. That's what so many people do. They say, well, I'm going to work on whatever it is, whether it's in chemical engineering or it's in sociology or history or whatever. The expert in this field is this, and I'll just further his work a little bit. Well, that's got a pitfall, because she's always going to know a lot more about your subject than you are, and they're going to be able to tell you which way to go and what to do, and it won't be yours. So here I am. I became aware during my semester at Mississippi State that there were Chinese in Mississippi. I didn't know that, and I became aware, furthermore, that they had a very precarious racial position because they weren't white, and they certainly didn't want to be, and for that matter, weren't black. And I learned that in two different places in the Mississippi Delta, which is where all the Chinese lived, there was actually a triply segregated school system. There's a white school, white schools, black schools, and a Chinese school. So I thought, this is pretty interesting. What does this say about the dynamics of segregation, which is built to be a bipolar system? You got a third race in this system. The Chinese started out black. That is, they started out as sharecroppers, and they ended up white. The most notorious example being that the headmistress of the all-white, if we include Chinese, Greenville, I think it's called the Greenville Academy. Anyway, it's the Greenville Private School in Greenville, Mississippi, which is the largest single town in the Delta. The headmistress is Chinese-American now. Well, she's always been Chinese-American, but she's now the headmistress. This shows a form of racial upward mobility. And some white folks, unthinking white folks, will say, well, see, this shows that it's those Negroes' own damn fault, because, look, the Chinese started out black and they made it. But that's totally inadequate for several reasons, but the most obvious reasons are two. One is the Chinese were less than 1% of the population. They could never be construed as a threat. At their height, there were 1,300 Chinese people in the Delta, and that's out of, 900,000 or something like that. And second of all, the Chinese are not being exploited by whites. That is, whites do not make their money by keeping Chinese people poor. The whites who deal with the Chinese were, in fact, wholesalers, because almost every single Chinese-American in Mississippi ran a grocery store. And so as the Chinese prospered, making money off of mostly black clientele, so did the distributors who were selling them stuff. So did, for that matter, the car dealers who were selling them Buicks. This is just the opposite of the situation with African-Americans. If African-American plantation workers were to double their income through some miracle the next year by working extra hard or by getting a minimum wage or something like that, that money would be coming directly from the pockets of the rich plantation owners. So whites had an interest in helping Chinese succeed. Some whites did. But whites had an interest in helping blacks fail.
I'm going to have to get that study.
It's still in print. I even made a movie out of it.
That's wonderful.
But, you know, I want to mention something else, if I might.
Uh-huh.
A while back you said I have a penchant for picking topics that nobody knows about. I'm on a new one, and I want to mention it. And if any of your listeners have any ideas for me, they can email them to me. I'm at jlowen.u. Well, I don't know where I am. I'm at www.uvm.edu/tilde J. Lowen. That's where I am. I have a website there, and people can take my little historical quiz and so on, and they can email me through the website. But my topic is this. I am writing a book about all-white towns, and I mean by that all-white towns that are all-white on purpose. Historically, especially in the Midwest, these are called sundown towns, because some of them, at their worst, even had signs at their city limits saying, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Benton," or whatever the name of the town. But we find them all over the country. Tonawanda and North Tonawanda, New York, for instance. I'm possibly investigating a town in Connecticut that did this with regard to Italian Americans, made them leave by sundown. All kinds of towns never let Jews settle in them, especially elite suburbs didn't, like Darien, Connecticut, which is notorious for it. But all across the U.S., we found and still find towns that in some cases drove all their blacks out or never let any come in. And generally this policy went into effect between about 1890 and 1930, which is a terrible time to be black or, for that matter, American Indian in the United States. So that's what I'm writing a book about.
Yeah, actually, I was going to lead into it when I talked about Lies Across America, because you talk about sundown towns.
I jumped the gun.
Yeah, you jumped the gun. That's okay. I want to actually move a little bit forward. You're interested in Mississippi, and you're interested in race. You wrote a textbook, did you not, about Mississippi?
Yes. I was so upset by this incident that I already related to you. That for about a year and a half, I tried to get people in the history department to write a new... What I did was I went to the high schools, and I watched students learning history. And this, I might add, was my students had graduated from all black high schools. This was just before massive school desegregation, which happened in January of 1970. And the experience I just related happened in January of 1969. So I went around learning what they were learning. And Tougaloo, I already mentioned, is a very good college. They had learned what they had been taught from black teachers in all black schools. They had learned this complete BS, this complete wrong story about Reconstruction and about many other topics, and because they were learning from a very biased textbook. So I put together a team finally, got a grant, students and faculty at Tougaloo and students and faculty at Millsaps College, the nearby white college, and we wrote a new history of Mississippi. And then the state rejected it for public school use. Their little textbook rating commission, which usually chose 3 to 5 books in any subject, in this subject they had exactly 2 books. We might call them ours and theirs. And they recommended theirs, and they refused to recommend ours. The vote was 2-5. There were 2 blacks and 5 whites on the rating committee. You can do the math. And it was a disgusting act because our book was much better than theirs. So we took them to court. And we had all kinds of expert witnesses, including from the white colleges and the black colleges. We had Margaret Walker Alexander, who's a famous black poet, author of Jubilee, the historical novel. We had a professor of English from Ole Miss. We had a professor of anthropology from Harvard. We had people from all over the U.S. And Mississippi saying our book was better in this area or that area or this area than their book. And the judge, who was an 83-year-old white Mississippian, agreed with us. He was a believer in the First Amendment, and he was bringing himself to believe in the 13th and 14th Amendments, and he made a good decision. So our book was adopted for 6 years by the state of Mississippi.
What led you to write the book that probably got you more fame than any of your other books because of how many people read it? Lies My
Sure.
Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Teacher Got Wrong. That came out in 1995.
Yes. Well, I went from Tougaloo to UVM.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes tell audiences I went from the blackest to the whitest college in America. It's all true. But I still like to teach first-year students, and I did. And I taught them in huge intro soc classes. Well, I give my students a quiz on the first day of class, whatever class it is. It's a different quiz depending on what course it is. And I try to find out what they know and ask them some questions we're going to use later on in the semester and so on. And my students convinced me from the answers to some of these quizzes that they didn't know nothing about American history. It was astounding. And, of course, it isn't just UVM students. This is a national finding. It just got found again by NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which found that students in history are even worse than we are in math and science and so on. Well, it's not just that they were worse. I even coined a new word. I call it socialexia, to describe the particular learning disability that students from the white upper middle class have with regard to ideas of sociology, and I'll maybe be talking about that some on Saturday over at Elizabethtown. Anyway, what this all convinced me of, students, of course, aren't taking sociology bad or well taught in high school, but they are taking American history. That's the course about our society that you take in high school. And my students were terrible at it. They didn't understand it, they didn't remember it, and they didn't get any kind of causality out of it. So again, I went off to the high schools and I read the textbooks that students were reading in high school and sat in on some of the classes, and I realized that Mississippi was just an exaggerated example of what is a national problem. And in many, many ways in 1970, say, Mississippi was an exaggerated example of national problems. So that's what caused me to read. I read 12 American high school history textbooks, and based lies my teacher told me on that, due to my UVM experience, really.
And in looking over these dozen textbooks, what patterns did you find in terms of the type of distortions?
First of all, I found they were stupefyingly boring. I'm sure people will remember that this was not their favorite course in high school. And if it was, that's an exception. There certainly are some teachers who do a great job. But on the whole, it's the least liked course in high school across America. And it's the most textbook dominated. And you'll remember the textbooks were the biggest and the hardest to lug home. And they've got these 50 or 60 questions at the end of each chapter, and you're supposed to answer them. What a drag. You know, when did the War of 1812 start, and so on. So that was maybe their number one characteristic, is boredom. But they also get all kinds of things wrong, and let me just mention a couple of them. The overall storyline is wrong. The overall storyline, without a doubt, is onward and upward, or we could call it automatic progress. Now, in a lot of ways, the United States is better off now than we were in, say, 1902. That's a century ago. I'd much rather have an infection in my leg now than in 1902. I'd much rather travel to Seattle now than in 1902. In many ways, we are better off. But the idea that progress is automatic and that progress occurs in all fields is ridiculous. But that's basically the subtext underlying the textbooks. We're more tolerant now, let's say. Well, that's bogus, and I can prove that and may talk to it on Saturday. And the idea that any of this is automatic is ridiculous. So it makes the textbooks boring because you don't have to really be a citizen. You don't have to do anything. It's all going to get fixed automatically. But the specific problems, lies even, begin with the beginning. Let's say Columbus isn't quite the beginning, but they certainly begin with Columbus. Almost everything we get in the textbook about Columbus is either wrong or unknowable. We don't really know if it happened. For instance, the notorious claim that one of the textbooks is still making, that Columbus's men were afraid of sailing off the edge of the earth. Mm-hmm. Complete nonsense. Everybody knew the world was round. The flat earth story is actually a creation of 1830 by a New Yorker, in fact, Washington Irving. It had nothing to do with thinking in 1491. So that and many of the other things we learn about Columbus are not true. And meanwhile, what we don't learn about Columbus that's important would fill a book and certainly fill the chapter of Lies My Teacher Told Me.
There a lot of what you talk about in the book are issues about race and hero worshiping and the way we distort reality because we like heroic personalities and stories of that sort. Are these common throughout? Beyond the 12 books, or is this characteristic of all of the books?
There were a couple of the books that were somewhat different from others, but on the whole, they were clones of each other. In fact, I actually found the same phrase recurring, and I think there's grounds for plagiarism lawsuits. I think that's even how they get written. Everybody in the books, just about, is treated as a hero. The number one exception, Benedict Arnold is not exactly treated as a hero, but the number one exception who is not treated as a hero is John Brown. It's very interesting, the prose used for him. It's very different from the prose used for Abraham Lincoln or even for, say, Stephen A. Douglas. What we find is that when you make people into a hero, the textbooks then seem to follow the rule, Every hero must be perfect. No feet of clay, not even a wart, not even a blemish. And so we don't learn stuff about the heroes. They don't come out as real people. And one of the results of this is that high school students don't treat the book seriously. And I know this because one of the questions I would ask UVM students, and I've asked probably 800 of them by now, is name a hero of yours in history and tell why. And people would behave quite astonishingly to that question. 30% of them left it blank. They left no other question blank. When they did answer it, a solid 10% wrote in the word none. Now, that's pretty nihilist, I think. Another 10% or more would write in something like, my grandmother. And then they'd tell me why their grandmother's a hero to them. And that's interesting, but that's still a deviation from the question. When they did answer, and over half of them did, it was never with Washington, Columbus, Jefferson, Franklin, any of those folks. It was usually people from another country. Back then, this would be 10 years ago, it was Gorbachev or Yeltsin, Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa. If it was an American, it was actually usually a black American. And these are, of course, white students at UVM, and they didn't know that I was the teacher of race relations at the school. This was an intro social, and I didn't have any reputation particularly. So it was fascinating to me that they did not answer the people they were, quote, supposed to answer. And I think what's going on is they didn't take the textbook presentations of those people seriously. I think what they instead inferred from the textbooks was American history is not a real important subject in high school. This isn't real.
Why are textbooks the way they are?
Well, I think there's two key reasons. One of them is author laziness. The reason being, well, let's suppose that you and I were going to write a textbook. And let's say that we're going to make you an expert on 19th century military history. Maybe you are an expert on 19th century military history. And I'm an expert on 20th century race relations. Well, right off the bat, here we are writing an American history textbook, and neither one of us claims expertise on Columbus or on the Indians. So what are we going to do? Well, let's say we flip a coin, and let's say I lose and I get Columbus. Now, what I ought to do is I ought to go off to the library, and it doesn't have to be the Library of Congress, which is one of the reasons I'm living in Washington, D.C. It could be the SUNY Plattsburgh Library, because there's a bunch of good books on Columbus that are even in probably the municipal library. A lot of them came out in 1992. That was a good year for Columbus books. If I just picked two of them and read them, I could write the two pages that we need for our textbook, or a page and a half, on Columbus. But that would take me the rest of the week, maybe even the weekend. So what am I going to do instead? Well, Scott Forsman, our publisher, has helpfully sent us half a dozen of our competitors. So why don't I just read what they say about Columbus, and then I'll just kind of rephrase it. And so that's what they do. And maybe you do the same thing on Indians, and so on, so far. When we get to our own era, maybe that part of the book will be halfway decent. But the rest of it, the textbooks just copy each other, and they therefore copy mistakes made. I actually traced one mistake back to 1913. And for that matter, we have this flat earth mistake, and that traced back to 1830. So author laziness is the first reason. The second reason is, also two words, publisher caution. The publishers, you know, let's suppose I wrote the part about the coming of the Civil War, one of the things I'd want to say would be that Franklin Pierce is my candidate for the second worst president of all time. Well, do I have to just say that? I mean, isn't that going to offend New Hampshire? He may not be much, but he's the only president they got, you know. So the publisher wants me to not quite say that. And if I don't want to offend New Hampshire on Pierce, I sure don't want to offend Texas on the Alamo. I don't want to offend Virginians with regard to what I say about Jamestown. Pretty soon, we can't say anything. So that's the second thing wrong.
What about the role of school boards and in terms of adoption of these books?
In about half the states, it's a statewide adoption process. All of the southern states and a sprinkling of others, about 23 or so states adopt statewide. But whether it's statewide or district-wide or even school-wide, it's usually teachers play a role in the process. They're often on the adoption committees. And so ultimately, we do have to fault teachers. They're not demanding better textbooks. But I have to say, it's hard to adopt a book that isn't before you. And with most of the books being clones of each other, it's kind of, you know, choosing between Twiddledum and Twiddledee. So teachers play a role, but they're not the key suspects.
What then would you suggest as a way of getting beyond this or improving the quality of our textbooks? Or should we just throw them out?
Yes, let's do that. I was struck dumb for a moment. I don't usually say, yes, let's do that. And one reason is because students do need a chronology. It's important. In fact, I tell teachers, I run teacher workshops sometimes, and one of my ideas is just get a bunch of butcher block paper, you know, that comes on those white rolls, run it around the whole top of your classroom. Not all the way around, because then it makes a circle and that's distracting, but run it across a couple of walls anyway, and make a timeline from, you know, when people first got to the Americas, whenever that might be, and there's an issue about that. Let's say run it to 70,000 BC, because that's one hypothesis, and run it up to, you know, maybe 2020. We can even have imaginary probable events in the future. And then locate everything on that timeline as you treat it. They need the chronology that a textbook supplies. They don't need the enormous detail. I would think it'd be great to adopt maybe a 200 to 300 page paperback textbook. And also use my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, or use Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, or use some other book that treats some subjects in depth and gets students thinking. I think it's a lot better to actually have a traditional textbook and my book than it would be to have a textbook of the sort I would approve and just have students memorize that. Because I don't want students to memorize anything. You know, well, I do actually want them to memorize that the Civil War started in 1861 and some things like that. But what I really want them to do is think about the issues of American history, and I think the best way to do that is to have more than one source in front of them.
I think that's an excellent idea, to have a textbook and a counter-textbook,
yeah,
and to talk about debate and controversy and bring that into the way we study our past. I don't want to let you go without getting to a book that is more recent, Lies Across America, in which you went around the nation looking at historic sites.
It was fun.
It must have been fun. What did you find?
Well, I found that, you know, students don't take history in college. Only one out of six Americans ever takes a history course after they leave high school, partly because they disliked it so much in high school. And so where did they learn history? Well, my dad made the family car stop at every damn historical marker on our vacations, and so we thought we were learning it from them. And what I'm finding out is many times we don't. We learn the opposite. Let me tell a really short, funny one that's
sure.
In your neighborhood.
Okay.
More or less. This is in Genesee County. I think that's near the Tonawanda Indian Reservation, so that must be a little northwest of you.
It's west.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There is the following official New York State historical marker. It was placed in 1932, and it says the following: Fording Place on Grand Central Trail, said to have been used by George Washington during the French and Indian War. And that's it. Well, I would first suggest any historical marker that says said to have, you know that didn't happen. But in this case, it turns out there was a George Washington who forded the river at that point. It just wasn't the George Washington that we usually think about. This George Washington was a Mohawk Indian who took the name George Washington and lived there, and he forded it. And this was actually pointed out to the state of New York 2 years after the marker went up in 1934, but the marker's still up there. I think that's pretty hilarious.
I think that's very hilarious. And one of the things I got from reading your book, Lies Across America, is that so many of the distortions have to do with race and have to do with, again, the same patterns.
Well, I have to say most of them are much more serious than that one. And yes, race has a lot to do with it. And I'm afraid that if you go around the country learning about the Civil War from our historic sites, you will learn all kinds of falsehoods about the Civil War, and it will be very sad. I mean, you will learn, for instance, that it was fought for states' rights, and that is the opposite of the truth. Gettysburg says that, and we might actually remember the North won at Gettysburg. For that matter, the United States won the Civil War, but the history of the Civil War on our landscape was pretty much written by the South, and not just the South, but the Confederate South. It was written between 1890 and 1930, the same period when sundown towns formed, the same period when race relations was so bad. And that's when we started to really massively mislearn our history. And I'm afraid that both the textbooks and the landscape still show all too many remnants of that sad era.
Actually, I was very much enlightened by your book. And we have a public history program at the University at Albany here in Ooh. Dubai. And I think your book should be required reading.
I hope so.
One of the other things that was fascinating is getting back to the hero, the pattern of hero worshiping, was your account of Buchanan. And,
yeah.
And the hidden history of Buchanan. Could you tell us a little bit about that before we close?
Sure. I think there's no doubt that President Buchanan, James Buchanan, just before the Civil War, was gay. Now, some people say, Lowen, you can't say that. They didn't even have the term back then. Okay, how about he was homosexual? I'll accept that correction. Some people say, you can't say that. They didn't even have the concept back then. Well, that's nonsense. There have been homosexuality and homosexuals in all societies for many, many millennia. If you read my book, I'm not going to get into the evidence here, but if you read my book, I don't think there's any way you can interpret the primary sources I quote there as other than we've already had a gay president. Of course, we know he was never married, but I went to Buchanan's house. This is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It's called Wheatlands. I recommend all of my listeners, why don't you go name your house right away? I think we need to have a name in my, you know, everybody's house. It's impressive. Anyway, you go to Wheatlands, and it's not the most impressive house in Lancaster, but it's a nice house. And the very first thing you learn is, well, we're here to talk about the house. We're not going to learn anything real about Buchanan. They actually say that. They didn't say the second sentence, but they said the first. Well, we didn't learn much about Buchanan, and in particular, when I asked point blank at the end of the tour, was he gay, the person giving the tour took our tiny group, consisting of four people, back up to the head of the stairs and showed us the portrait of the woman to whom he was engaged for a couple of months when he was in his early 20s. And this proves he wasn't gay. Well, in fact, it's more evidence that he was, because she broke off the engagement, in the words of a friend of hers, because he could not seem to show her proper affection. But they, in other words, they just directly lie. And then I asked, well, how was he on slavery? And I got back this sentence, and this is virtually verbatim. He was against it. All of the people in this area were. Well, they got the area right. The area is full of Mennonites and Quakers and Amish to this day. But even his church, the Presbyterian Church, disbarred him from communion because he was so pro-slavery. And it turns out that these two lies are connected. One of the reasons that he was so pro-slavery was because his gay partner for many years was none other than a senator from Alabama, William Rufus King, briefly vice president of the United States, with whom Buchanan was in love. And, of course, both of them then became members of the far-out pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party. Well, it's a terrible thing to go to a historic site and end up stupider about Buchanan than before you went there.
Altogether, too many of these sites around this nation. But I'm going to close with one thing. You do. There's one state that comes off really well in your book, and that's Maine.
Yes.
And why is that?
Well, it's kind of nihilist of me, but Maine doesn't have any state historical markers. It's the only state that never had a state historical. Of course, there's markers on the landscape of Maine, but the furthest east marker I could find, which is on a little island out in Maine, is one of these funny markers that you can actually buy from novelty stores. And I think it's accurate. It's on Great Gott Island, and it says, on this site in 1897, nothing happened. As far as I know, they're right.
And on that note, we're going to close this interview. Thank you, Dr. James
Lowen. Nice talking with you. I've enjoyed it a lot. I hope the listeners have.